Part of my fascination with history stems from the realization that we are them. What I mean here is that from the dawn of recorded history until now, not a lot of time has passed, certainly not on an evolutionary scale. We're better off today, of course, because of better nutrition, sanitation, and medicine. But we are fundamentally the same semi-hairy apes we were back in the 4th millennium BCE when things first started getting written down. And that means if I were living in the past, I would be pretty much the same. I might be uncomfortable, unwell, and illiterate, but hey, so is everyone else. I'd be no different from those around me. And that's where the fascination comes in. If I didn't have a smartphone, which I didn't for most of my life, what would I be doing for information or entertainment? Going backwards, I'd be watching television, or going to a movie, or listening to the radio, or reading a book, or catching a play, or heading to the tavern, or gossiping by the fire. I'd still be me, but my options would change. So how would I spend my time in 1635, in 1035, in 35? How would things be different, and how would they be the same? That's the premise of the podcast we're sharing today, What We Did Before. In the episode you're about to hear, archaeologists find an ancient Bronze Age settlement and uncover loads of human bones. But they weren't found in just one place, like a burial ground. They were everywhere, as if the people living then were collecting them. Is this what we did before funeral homes? I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow What We Did Before. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. History Daily is sponsored by Shopify. Now, I shop online, like all of us, I assume, but it's startling how different the shopping experience can be store to store. Finding what you're looking for is often tough enough, but some sites make the actual purchase so difficult. I know I've abandoned full carts because of a bad UI or poor experience, and it's infuriating. So I'm always glad to see that little purple Shop Pay button. Clean checkout with all my information pre-filled. It's a small thing. But I'm here to buy something, not do a bunch of data entry. Well, behind that purple Shop Pay button is Shopify, the commerce platform powering millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Heinz and Mattel to brands just getting started. With Shopify, you can easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and more. So see less carts go abandoned and more sales go... Choose Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/historydaily. Go to shopify.com/historydaily. That's shopify.com/historydaily.
Imagine returning home to your village after a busy day to be greeted by human skulls on pikes. You head home to see the femur of your great aunt lying on the floor and the skull of your grandma proudly displayed on your mantelpiece. It might sound macabre, but for some Bronze Age communities, this might have been a reality. You see, before burying our dead in the ground became the norm, our ancient ancestors had many different ways of dealing with the deceased. And quite often, they'd simply rip a dead body apart.
I always think if I lived in prehistory, I'd like to be one of those lucky few who made it into a cemetery. You knew what was happening, you know?
That's Barry Malloy, an archaeologist who has just uncovered the most unexpected surprise at a Bronze Age site in Central Europe.
Every time we were sticking a spade in the ground on the settlements, we just kept finding human remains.
I'm Ollie Giu, and this is What We Did Before, where we explore the history of everyday life. And today, Barry is here to discuss his incredible findings and what we did before burial. Barry Malloy, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for the invitation to join.
Well, I was so fascinated when I saw your recent discovery, your recent work looking at what are quite surprising burial practices of ancient people, if you can call them burial practices at all, because they weren't exactly burying their dead. In fact, your paper is titled The Unburied Dead. Can you tell me about the research that you've been doing?
Yeah, I could give you a little bit of background, I suppose, first. We're looking at the Bronze Age in the Carpathian Basin, so that's in Central Europe, well, Central to Southeast Europe, and we're looking at a period, roughly speaking, from 1500 to 1200 BC. that's called the Late Bronze Age. And it's a period where people might be familiar with things like in New Kingdom Egypt, Tutankhamun, the Trojan War, that kind of thing. So just to broadly locate you in time and space, we were interested really in what's happening in this really central part of Europe. It's a very well connected area, so what happens there is important. But earlier in the Bronze Age, we had these Tell settlements, this big complex, I suppose, society in the area. And it had collapsed sometime around 1500 BC. And we were interested in, well, what's happening next in this area at this time of all these other societies coming to their height and it's a really big globalized Bronze Age world. So we went investigating the settlements of the area and we found these huge fortified sites. And that was something quite unexpected. We didn't realize to find this, like over 100 of these massive fortified sites. And that includes one that was known previously, which is called Cernișoara Iorcuri, the biggest prehistoric site in Europe, I think. It's massive, massive fortified site.
When you say fortified, how were they fortifying it?
They were building ditches around the sites, often quite large ditches. They might be 5-6 meters across. They could be 2, 3, even 4 meters deep. And some of them then would have had walls like palisades, so wooden and earthen walls going around the inside. So they were quite keen on keeping what they had inside and keeping people who wanted to take it on the outside.
Is this surprising because we didn't necessarily know they were doing this wide scale in the Bronze Age, that this sort of complex architecture almost?
Yeah, I mean, that was a surprise for us because we had known of Cernișoara Iorcuri, this massive site, and there was one or two others known. So these are kind of seen as these isolated phenomena. But then our research, looking at aerial imagery, then going down onto the ground, driving around, finding these sites on the ground, we discovered over 100 of these sites over the course of maybe 3 or 4 years. So it went from knowing of one or two isolated sites to seeing this as a whole complex of these sites covering this whole landscape.
And so you were there looking at these incredible fortifications. Did you expect to find what you did in terms of the sort of ancient burial practices?
Well, that was the thing. Like we were interested in learning about the lives of the people that lived in these sites. So we were looking at the mortuary archaeology. But then when we were digging these settlements, we just kept finding human remains. So we're digging the ditches, we find human remains. We dig pits, we find human remains. Even when a slightly later period, going to about, 900 BC, 800 BC, we're finding humans in complete burials, bits of burials in the remains of houses. So every time we were sticking a spade in the ground on the settlements, we were finding them. So, the cemeteries, so we thought that's where they're putting the dead, but no. They're doing a lot more with the dead than we expected.
Kind of an archaeologist dream in a way to find something wherever you put your spade.
yeah, it was. I mean, we've only dug the sites we're digging. We might have dug 0.01% of the site, and literally every single trench we're finding human remains. So often in small quantities, but it's when we look at the size of these sites and the tiny bit we dug, the fact that there's everywhere we go we find it means these are widespread throughout the settlement.
What condition are these human remains in when you do find them?
They can be quite varied. We often find small fragments of them, and they were broken up before being put in the ground. And we also find sometimes complete things, like we find occasionally complete skulls or large portions of complete skulls. We find complete arm and leg bones, these kind of things in the ditches. In our surrounding area, we do sometimes find complete burials. There's some in Hungary where they suspect people were bound and buried in the pit. We don't know if they were tied and killed and put in or buried alive. We don't really know, but we're finding, just complete remains, disturbed remains and bits of remains on these settlements.
And so the fact that they were scattered and not all in one place, as you suggest, means that they weren't being buried in one particular space like we would today, like we would expect. So what was happening then? Why were they kind of littered about the place?
Well, it seems even then there was a couple of different reasons. And I can say it's not as clear as we'd like it to be. But what we did is a new method of histotaphonomy, which is my colleague Tom Booth over in the Crick Institute in London. He uses CT scans of bones. And from that, he's able to say, was this bone exposed to the air for a long time before it was buried? Or was this bone, attached to a person or otherwise, buried in the ground very soon after death? And we are finding examples of bones that had been exposed straight after death. They're exposed for a period of time to the elements. And that leans into this burial practice we call excarnation. where people are exposed and their bodies are allowed to decompose in the air. Presumably on a platform or something, we don't get like animal gnaw, we don't get rodent gnaw marks like rats or mice or anything climbing aboard to start chewing at the flesh. So they're in a protected space, but their bodies were decomposing, it seems. Others seem to have been physically broken apart while still fresh. I know that's quite gooey and maybe in our view, at least, not how we normally expect the treatment of the dead to take place. But we had like one example where the cranial vault had been cracked open with something like an axe. So we don't know if that was breaking the head apart to break it, or were they actually trying to access the brain? Mm. But a net effect is they were getting inside the skull, and that was very soon after death.
So accessing the brain, we know that at least in sort of ancient Egypt, a lot of people thought the heart was the sort of control center of the body and not the brain. The brain was seen actually more as sort of a kind of useless organ in many ways. It's only in fairly recent times that we've had that perspective shifted. So is it possible that they wanted the brain for something, or that they were just trying to remove it so that they could make these skulls, you know, lighter and more decorative?
I'm afraid with the fragments we get, we just can't tell that. We don't have the complete body. All that we have remaining is that that tiny small fragment of the skull that tells us that they had, you know, accessed, they'd broken it and they'd accessed it. So, you know, we were between, was it the brain that they were after, or was deconstructing the skull that they were looking to do? I know we've one other case where we've got, again, this was not what you expect when you're excavating. We found the frontal bone of a person. So basically from around here back to middle of the head, just this top part of the skull, but it had a hole in it. And you'd expect something like this might be from an injury. They might've been shot with an arrow or a sling or something. But then we noticed that the hole was actually from the inside of the skull, not from the outside. So this had been somehow pierced with a stake. Something had gone, probably when it's a complete skull, it had gone through the base of the skull and out through the top of the skull.
Hmm.
And we looked at examples from around Europe. There weren't many parallels, but we had some from Sweden from a much earlier period. And they appear to have been putting heads on spikes there. So we can't tell that, but it has the physical characteristics that would be like, you know, someone had put this on a spike.
Yeah. So either putting a head on a spike of an enemy that you've sort of defeated, or doing it to sort of proudly display a deceased loved one, those are two possibilities, right?
They could be, yeah. And I mean, the thing is, we find these in the ditches surrounding the sites, a lot of these remains. So you imagine these are large sites. This one where we found this is 200 hectares in size. And we find these at the boundary. So that's kind of right. If you're entering into the site, you have to pass through these boundaries, go through a causeway, like a drawbridge, except it's built of earth. So you go through this causeway into the site. And that's where we're finding the human remains sometimes.
Mm.
So this instance of the head where it had been pierced, if that had been displayed, it was displayed as you're going into the site. So everybody coming in and leaving that would have seen it. So yeah, part and parcel of your experience of visiting these places.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm sort of building up this mental image of it now. It kind of looks quite gothic in a way.
History Daily is sponsored by Shopify. Now, I shop online like all of us, I assume, but it's startling how different the shopping experience can be store to store. Finding what you're looking for is often tough enough, but some sites make the actual purchase so difficult. I know I've abandoned full carts because of a bad UI or poor experience, and it's infuriating. So I'm always glad to see that little purple Shop Pay button. Clean checkout with all my information pre-filled. It's a small thing, but I'm here to buy something, not do a bunch of data entry. Well, behind that purple Shop Pay button is Shopify, the commerce platform powering millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Heinz and Mattel to brands just getting started. With Shopify, you can easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and more. So see less carts go abandoned and more sales go... Choose Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/historydaily. Go to shopify.com/historydaily. That's shopify.com/historydaily.
Tell me a little bit a bit more about excarnation, because this seems like a strange practice to leave the body exposed to to the air to decompose like that outside of a grave. Why would that have been a practice by ancient people?
It's a challenging question. I mean, we don't have enough dead people in cemeteries. So you have this question in archaeology of what are they doing with the dead? You know, if we have cemeteries with a couple of tens of people spread over 200-300 years, that's not the living population. So the other people were going somewhere else. Something was happening with them. But at this time, we have cremation as a burial practice. And cremation in this period, they weren't taking what they will, I'm sure your viewers all know what cremation is, but basically at this time, they put them on a wooden pyre and they'd burned this for several hours. It would burn down. And then you've got the charred remains of the person there. The fragments tend to be quite large. You know, you can pick them up and see them. It's not like the modern day cremation when you get the ashes back. This is kind of burnt bone. But they only went and retrieved some of these bones and put them into the urn. So it's kind of a token element of a person was often seen to be enough to represent the person. But it also means that the other bits of that person went somewhere else. They were left at the site, they were put in a river. But the ultimate thing is that bodies were broken apart in death and they were separated. So they weren't treated as an integral human being. They didn't need every bit of you to represent you. So that fragmentation seems to then translate across into the bodies that weren't burned. So excremation, the body's going to basically decompose into its parts and they can be dealt with separately then from decomposition rather than fire.
Do you think that's potentially because we hadn't developed formal religion by this point, and so the body was seen more practically than spiritually like it is today?
I think that we have this sense of the body and the individual, and my colleague Joe Brook in Dublin has done a lot of work on this, but this idea of that we see that when a person dies, that their body goes into the ground and we remember that individual. That might be I can go to a cemetery and find a gravestone that has my great-great-grandfather's name or great-great-grandmother's name on it. And I can, you know, think back to that as an individual. But Joe's work was suggesting that, you know, once you go one or two generations down the line, you've got this more generic ancestors. So their belief was that you join the ancestors, perhaps, when you die. Now, the extent to what that's part of a religious practice or religious beliefs, we don't know. But there's more this kind of generalized sense of ancestors. And we think that that's part of what's happening with the human remains, that when they're buried, they can be broken apart. And, if you're using a part of this, it's not necessarily my great-great-grandmother. It can be an ancestor from this family lineage or from our community that I'm actually accessing.
Just a quick one. If you're enjoying this and you like weird stories from human history like this, do hit subscribe. It helps the channel out massively. Right, back to Barry. So it sounds like there was no typical way of burying or dealing with the dead in ancient times. There doesn't seem to be a practice that was more common than others. Would you agree?
I would. Like, I always think if I lived in prehistory, I'd like to be one of those lucky few who made it into a cemetery. You knew what was happening. You know, you would die and your body might be buried, might be cremated. Where it just seems such a myriad ways of how the bodies were treated after death. And it's our biggest challenge is a lot of these don't leave archaeological traces. You know, we're so lucky to have accessed the material to have understood that this was excremation because we found these few bones. And using this CT scanning method, we're able to define, yeah, excremation is what explains this. But that's a rarity. And it's only recent years we've had that technology that can translate a little bit of a bone to telling us about the mortuary practices and how the body was dealt with before it was buried.
And so can we speculate a little bit about what these bones would have been used for, or like day to day, or like in the home, for instance? Like, why would they have been retrieving and collecting these bones other than just to represent the ancestors?
My suspicion is they're doing it for a variety of reasons. I mean, there's even down to disrespecting the dead. Like, you know, this could be the body. We often think of this in terms of the ancestors. You're getting retrieving the body of someone you care about. They can also be disturbing the graves of enemies, of enemy groups. It can be a very disrespectful treatment. So we can imagine when they're retrieving bones from burials and they're also retrieving bones from excremations. They might be also physically breaking bodies apart. So there's a lot of different pathways to how bits of the body would have ended up in a community. And we've no idea if that was all one thing. Like, there might have been, we've one site Vatin, where you had a bunch of skulls just outside of a house. So you might imagine in that context, these skulls possibly had been in the house for a period, and they might have been experienced, but then they might have, you know, come to an end of that role, an end to that function, and then, you know, they might have been treated not quite like garbage, but basically when that meaning got transformed, that they weren't needed anymore. So they're placed outside the house, and these were found outside of a house in a rubbish tip. So again, one reading is, oh, they didn't care about these people, they were disrespecting them by putting into a rubbish tip. But it could also be that the meaning had changed. They had served their purpose, they had been there for however many moons, whatever it might be, and after that, they could be gotten rid of. We have other examples where we have human remains broken apart or complete crania placed into pits in the ground alongside animal bones that had been butchered. So again, is that disrespectful? Is it respectful? Are you putting somebody together with the remains of a feast? Or are you treating the body as basically discard, as rubbish? This part of the body, we can put it in with these animal bones in a pit. It's hard to read, but when we bring it all together, we can see that there's clearly different pathways, that human remains are experienced differently, sometimes respectful, sometimes not, on the same settlement.
Yeah, I can imagine there being a huge amount of respect to the human body through this practice, because on the one hand, it is, in the modern day, it sort of seems disrespectful if we were just to start pulling apart a body and putting, mm-hmm. The arm bone in one house and their feet in another, for instance. But in ancient times, perhaps it was seen differently, in that it was about keeping that person with you in some way, rather than going to visit a grave. You've got a physical representation of them that is with you, that you get to hold on to. And then perhaps, you know, like when your parents die and you have the job of clearing out their house, for instance, so that you can sell it, that's what happens. The next generation, their parents die and they say, oh, they've hoarded so many human bones, we better discard them. And it's a process of elimination like that. But it starts, you can imagine, it starts as this way of respecting the dead and keeping them close to you so that you don't, I suppose, so that you never feel so far away from death. Because I think actually in the modern day now, we do feel a little bit disconnected from death, and we've made that separation almost intentionally. Maybe it was a healthy way to be in ancient times.
It was. We have this, as you say, this real division between death and life, even in terms of the way we experience dead people. It's in a cemetery. It's in a very specific part. Like we look at a modern city or even a village, the cemetery is a part of the town. So you've got your living area where you're walking around experiencing your lived life. And if you want to engage with the dead, you go to this walled off place, this secluded place that's marked with very particular monuments. And you know you're in a cemetery when you're in a cemetery, and you know you're not when you're not. I know that might seem simple, but in these contexts, that division wasn't there. That the place of the living, the place of the dead intersected. You had dead people all around you. And I mean, that can be the recent deceased. It can be like if you've experienced loss and you don't want to let that person go. I mean, we've intramural burials, people buried beneath houses. That kind of thing also happens, where the people are kept close. But also, I'm thinking even of, you've got in Iron Age Greece, you've got these hero cults where they actually went around plundering Bronze Age graves. That was their age of heroes. And they were looking for Odysseus and Agamemnon, these characters. And they're finding an ancient burial. They're taking a bone out of it. Kind of almost like the medieval Christian tradition. They're coming back with these relics saying, like, I have the bone of Achilles. And oh, this is going to bring great fortune to our family. So there's also that intergenerational gap that you got. We have this kind of sense of, like I said earlier, our great-great-grandparent means something to us. We have no idea in these societies, going back that many generations, you know, they're a common ancestor, they could be a hero, and bringing those relics from what they would have recognized as a previous time. It empowers those relics. It could be a good luck charm. So the human body is completely changed into material culture then. It's like, you know, the skull is a lucky charm. That really seems weird to us. But in these times, they were very, very different, I suppose, moral sense of what the human body meant in part or in whole.
A different sense of grave robbing back then, a more heroic than it might potentially be seen now. And also, I don't know whether it would have been, whether the fact that generations came more quickly back in those times, because people didn't live as long, whether that would have mattered as well to people wanting to preserve the memory of people because they simply weren't around in their lives for as long.
That's true as well, yeah. I mean, it's... it's very hard archaeologically to get that that time span, that the relics and remains of literally people you knew in your lifetime and you knew where they're buried. If you're retrieving those, it's the person you're retrieving. So having them close to you, having them within your settlement, it can relate to that kind of managing loss, managing the emotional experience of it.
You obviously see, ancient dice, for instance, were often made of bone, not human bone, but made of bone. Could you imagine, given that their presence in the home was so abundant, potentially these were being used as tools or some sort of, cups, cutlery, other more practical uses, because you sort of simply needed to use everything that you could get your hands on in the Bronze Age?
Well, we're looking at quite prosperous societies here, so I don't think there would have been a needs-must treatment to it, but I think human remains, while they were a material culture, they were still treated as being human in some sense. They didn't lose that human value, so they didn't become kind of a utilitarian parts of human culture. I know there's other examples from prehistory of using human skull fragments to make combs, things like this. But again, I think that's really, really, that's transforming it, but it's retaining the human value. It's not just becoming a comb. It's becoming a comb made from a human skull fragment. Like in our case, we've got one settlement to be excavated at Sakule, where we had a human femur, and it was a part of it. And the reason we only had a part of it was that a dog had been chewing on this. So this was within a domestic space. There was a dog sitting down, happily chewing away on some relative or some ancestor, whatever it might have been. But it was a fairly recently dead person, so it would have been known to the people on the settlement. And yet the dog just sat there and chewed it, and it was discarded along with animal bones in the same domestic area.
Yeah,
quite unexpected, you could say.
Deeper respect for recycling that they had. and do we see that we've had sort of mortuary practices for pretty much all of history? Obviously there would have, I'm assuming there would have been a time where we simply just left the dead where they lay, especially if we were migrating. But for the span of at least Homo sapiens, have we got good evidence that we have been doing some sort of burial for dead ancestors, dead relatives?
Going back into the late Upper Paleolithic, so going back into, from the top, like 12,000 BC, something like this, we've from then onwards, we've got consistent evidence of burial practices. But it's also important to remember that burial ritual, or mortuary ritual, and burial aren't necessarily the same thing. That we kind of equate when you die, that a physical space is created and your body's put into it and sealed and contained there. But just taking the example of excarnation, there's many other things. It could be like cave burials, there could be river burials, there's so many things that how you dispose of the body is perhaps less important than the rituals that might have taken place around it. And we find it hard archaeologically to detect, it going back deeper in time. But that doesn't mean that people weren't treating the human body in a ritual at death in a particular manner, because we have those examples from like Shandidar Cave in Iraq of the Neanderthal burials. There's also in La Chapelle aux Saints in France, the Neanderthal burials. We even have it in South Africa at Rising Star Cave. You've got the Homo Naledi, which is it's pre-human, but kind of not. It's a hominid, so like us, but on a different evolutionary branch. It didn't kind of evolve into us. And they seem to have been bringing their dead into a cave. Whether they're burying them or not isn't clear. That's a bit of debate, or an area of quite a bit of debate at the moment. But the fact that they're bringing them into the cave, they're pulling them in through these narrow passages, they were removing them from places where they would be eaten by predators. So they're treating the dead in a particular way. So I think mortuary practices and dealing with that death, dealing with death as a transformational state, but still engaging with the body thereafter in some way, is something that is really a deep part of the human lineage.
Yeah, and on the podcast recently, we actually tackled this new research from Tinshmeth Cave in Israel, where it suggests that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens may have collaborated in many respects on the evolution of their culture and their beliefs and potentially their burial practices as well. So it's possible you go back to Neanderthal burial that Homo sapiens was sort of learning from what they were doing.
I mean, this is fully possible. I'm reminded of when I was an undergraduate in the last millennium, I was an undergraduate in the 1990s, there was a lecture on Neanderthal society, shall we say. The speaker at the end, the question was asked, you know, would humans and Neanderthals perhaps have, coalesced through mating? And the response at the time was, well, would you copulate with a gorilla? Which it was said in jest, but basically at the time, the very idea of interbreeding between species, this is going back 30 years, that was outlandish. And then genetics came along and flipped that on its head. And then we see that they were interbreeding, and that means there was social and cultural interaction between them. So in terms of how beliefs evolved, I don't know, there's complexity there, but in terms of maybe the Neanderthals influencing and the Homo sapiens influencing, there was probably 10,000 years or more of these groups living in the same territories, interacting with each other. That's a long time. So I don't know, I must say, I don't know the exact details of the site you're talking about, but it's not something these days that would surprise me to hear of this collaboration.
And do we have signs of other, you've talked about cave burials, river burials, are there any other practices that humans have used throughout history that archaeology has been able to uncover, or and maybe any particularly surprising ones?
Well, we seem to be infinitely creative with how we deal with the dead when we go back. When you look in global perspective, I mean, you have the, as many people know, for example, you've got those the child burials, the Peruvian mummies, you have these child burials in the caves high in the Andes, where they were kind of tightly bound together and placed into caves. We have throughout northwestern Europe, and quite a few examples in Ireland, of these bog bodies, where I suppose burial might be glorified way of saying what happened to them, because they were downright nasty what happened to these people. They were people brought to the bogs and they were killed in myriad different ways, often. Yeah, one or two examples from Ireland where you can see the variety of treatments, and they didn't die well, but they were placed into the bog afterwards. So that's the use of the body. It's not how we consider burial. The body's been used in a ritual there, perhaps to mark a space, perhaps to have a transformative effect on the landscape. We have ossuaries, which is, it's still something we find in the Orthodox religion in Greece, Orthodox Christianity. You're buried for a period of time. Your body's retrieved, it's cleaned, and then in many cases it's placed into a communal pit, shall we say, or a space where there is just loads of other human remains. So the body is disaggregated and just put with others. And we have like really bizarre versions of that. You've got the Sedlec church over in Czechia, where they've got the entire church inside is decorated with human remains. And it's, I mean, there's a chandelier is made from human bones, there's pillars are decorated with human bones. And again, that's because it seems macabre, but that's because the church itself is built on the story is it's built on soil brought back from the Holy Land, as they have it in that religion. And so the church is there, and everybody wanted to be in it. There wasn't enough space, so they did this with them. But yeah, I think it's down to, for us, the body is inseparable. When you die, we believe it should be treated together as a holistic thing. But there's so many examples throughout the world where the body will be disaggregated and used in very creative and different ways.
Is it possible that, especially given your recent research, bones could have been used as some form of currency? Or would you see like markings which would determine that more clearly if it was the case that these were used for trading or some other form of currency like that?
We don't have anything that would necessarily say that they were used as currency. But again, there can be that sense of value in relics and value in specific things, because when you look at medieval times, saintly relics were actually traded. I mean, there are chips of the True Cross. I mean, I'm sure there was enough chips of wood there to build a cathedral out of the amount of chips of the True Cross circulating. But with human remains as well, like we've got St. Valentine in Dublin here where I live, the relics of St. Valentine in a church. But that was commonplace then, and I mentioned earlier that you had in Greece searching for these elements of the heroes of the heroic age, of the Bronze Age, and that these were often, people were told by the Delphic Oracle, go find these. So in that sense, bones could have value, but I think it's a culturally embedded value that it was a bone of someone or something, rather than the bone itself having value intrinsically because it is bone.
How accurately could they have determined whether they really had unearthed Achilles heel, for instance, you know, a bone of an ancient hero. Obviously, even now, we've got incredible ability to sort of, you know, map genetics and really, you know, this new research that you've been doing as well, looking at how long it's been exposed to the elements. Was a lot of it just story and legend in terms of what they unearthed and what they called it and what a society was willing to believe that bone, who that bone belonged to?
Yeah, I think it's kind of, you find what you want to find. So if you've no evidence, you're finding exactly what it is, you make damn sure that the people around you believe that you did find it. So you come back with a nice creative story with the hardships, the whatever you went through, and you might have been going, you know, 14 fields over and finding a grave that you knew of and just retrieving bones from it. But it's all about the story, I suppose, around them and the narrative that's built up in that same way. And I think the Christian relics in Europe are just a great example of that, where it's the story that matters. Like even things like the Turin Shroud. I mean, it has a lineage passed through all of these hands that moved around, and it's kind of, it became more convincing to some people that it was this religious relic, the more it had a storied history, the more it had been valued by others. So receiving it then became a prestigious thing. You had this thing. And I think it's similar with these human remains. But where were they getting the actual bones of Achilles? I seriously doubt that they had that memory, that information, yeah.
And do we see that there were particular bones in the body which seemed to be collected more often than other bones?
Yeah, well, I mean, in our case, they definitely had something of a fascination with the skull and with long bones. We don't tend to find shoulder blades or hips, you know, pelvis or scapulae. We don't find ribs. We don't find vertebrae from the spine. They're not commonly found when they're redepositing bones. Like we even have one ditch at an Iron Age site where they have a whole segment of this ditch just full of human bones, but it's all long bones laid out neatly, and then the skulls are placed in one part altogether. But they were focused on these, and I don't know, you could get creative in trying to understand why. I mean, you have the thinking part, you have the parts that move, the parts that we experience, you know, you're shaking hands with somebody, but that's just me wildly speculating, because I'm sure that they had many, many different reasons. But it is these bigger bones that tend to be the focus of attention.
Yeah, you can sort of imagine them using them as clubs for sort of gladiator-style battles. Maybe that's why they collected the long ones. There's loads of reasons why it could have happened.
Yeah, we get them both complete and broken. And when they're broken, a lot of the time, they seem to have been broken in what we call the perimortem stage. So they were broken while they were still a bit gooey. They weren't like dried old bones that are getting and breaking. So even in cases when they dig up bones from older burials, they're ones we often find intact. It's the more recently deceased ones. It's only a couple of cases, but they seem to have been green, basically the stage very soon after death when the bones are broken.
You mentioned that this society where you unearthed all of these bones being sort of scattered almost like litter was quite affluent. Do we expect that if you were to do more research in other affluent Bronze Age sites and settlements, we might find the same, or was this quite a unique location from what you're understanding?
I'm convinced that we would, yeah. I mean, I mentioned that very early about my colleague Jo Brooke doing work like this over in England, and she was finding burials that when they're originally excavated, people kind of count it as poorly recorded or a mistake in the excavation. You know, you've got two skulls from this burial. It's only one body and two skulls. What have you done? And so she was able to go back and look at the records and going, no, there was additional elements in this burial. Somebody had placed part of another person into this burial. So, you know, in Britain, we know in Ireland, they were doing this. We know in Czechia, they're doing really macabre things with individuals there. You have a site called Velim, which is all the ditch around the site is full of complete and disturbed human remains. So in Hungary, they've got, again, lots and lots of human remains on settlements. Sometimes you'll have burials in pits where you've got most of the person, but then, you know, the right leg and the right arm might be missing. So it is a wider spread phenomenon, but I think part of it is, where people looking when they were digging? It's only in recent years, maybe 20, 30 years, that people have systematically retained animal bones when they're digging. And then these will be studied later. And that's where we find often the human bones, because when you're digging, you're going through volumes of soil. It's a bone, it's a bone, it's a bone. You're not identifying that in the ground. So if you haven't been keeping the animal bones, you almost certainly, unless it was a complete burial, you weren't going to find and retain the human bones.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess the concept of the bones being pulled apart and dismantled and separated was perhaps just simply not on people's radar.
I think that's exactly it. Yeah. So I suspect if we start looking more, we're definitely going to start finding a lot more. You have burials within the settlement is commonplace from the Neolithic onwards, but they're kind of formal burials where they dig a pit and they place the person like beneath the ground. But we're looking at these, what you might call more anomalous burials, where they're not necessarily buried in a specific grave cut. Like they're put into pits, they're put into bits of houses, they're put into ditches, they're already half filled with rubbish. So they're not kind of creating a mortuary space. That's quite different. But again, it's when we start looking, I think we're going to start finding it more frequently. And I've probably done some colleagues a disservice who are looking at this going, but we found it in our settlement. So I'm sure that there is cases out there already that they haven't come to my attention, but I know it's not going to be a unique thing that we found.
History Daily is sponsored by Shopify. Now, I shop online, like all of us, I assume, but it's startling how different the shopping experience can be store to store. Finding what you're looking for is often tough enough, but some sites make the actual purchase so difficult. I know I've abandoned full carts because of a bad UI or poor experience, and it's infuriating. So I'm always glad to see that little purple Shop Pay button. Clean checkout with all my information pre-filled. It's a small thing. But I'm here to buy something, not do a bunch of data entry. Well, behind that purple Shop Pay button is Shopify, the commerce platform powering millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Heinz and Mattel to brands just getting started. With Shopify, you can easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and more. So see less carts go abandoned and more sales go... Choose Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/historydaily. Go to shopify.com/historydaily. That's shopify.com/historydaily.
And when you say this site was sort of affluent, what does that mean in the Bronze Age? Because obviously our idea of affluence today is a bit different. Yeah, so how can you tell it was a site where people were, had abundance?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We were for a long time in archaeology quite obsessed with finding elites and digging elite burials and these kind of things, or if we're digging a settlement trying to find the biggest building that might be the place of the king, something like this. It's only more recent years that we've been kind of looking more broadly at how settlements fit together and how they were built and how the communities kind of evolved within them. So in our case, we're looking at... Like at Cornishty, you've got, that's a huge site, as I mentioned. That's like, I think, 35 kilometers of ditches. At our sites, a small site might be 1 or 2 kilometers of ditches. Bigger sites, maybe, 7, 8, 9 kilometers of ditches. That's a huge investment. So they're kind of showing the affluence through building these big places. But we think within them that they're also using these to contain their herds. And that gives us a sense of them having a lot of animals. So... animals was a form of wealth, but it's not one we can identify so easily archaeologically. But also in the traditional sense, we've got just shed loads of bronze. They had a lot of metal. So they were making, dress pins, ornaments, razors, swords, spears, shields, armor, cooking devices, everything out of bronze. It was, you're tripping over bronze. So they had no shortage of metals. And then, like we even found recently, my colleagues found on a gas pipeline, they found a little pot just randomly in a field and just full of these little gold hair ornaments. So there was quite a bit of gold in circulation as well. We found that a couple of settlements like Santana in Romania, which is close to us. And again, there they found plenty of gold in that settlement. So All your key markers of affluence from the prehistoric world, having access to lots of metal, access to precious metals, sustaining large herds, having large human labor forces. These are all kind of symbols of wealth and prosperity.
And I know this requires a bit of speculation, as I've made you speculate quite a bit in this episode.
No worries.
I do wonder if you have a view on why we deal with the dead in the way that we do in the modern age. If in history we did treat them almost as sort of objects that we could take apart and put in our home. I know we've been through various iterations of burial, you know, obviously in ancient Egypt, those are very well known. But, you know, today, I don't think I've ever seen a dead body in real life. I don't recall having ever seen one, actually. I'm not even sure I've been to a funeral with an open casket. So do we see in archaeology when this transformation happened? And have you got some ideas of why?
It's hard to see of when it happened. I mean, thinking in terms of things like globalization, let's all blame globalization, but basically as our cities have developed, I mean, things have become so much less personal. Like we've millions of people living together, and cemeteries are a small, tiny, isolated part of these big communities. But when you go to rural communities, you still have a much closer link between the cemetery and people living around it. And I think it's that break in larger settlements that's kind of broken tradition. Because in Ireland here, we have this thing called the wake. When somebody dies, you don't leave the dead body alone on the first night of death. So friends, relative, family will spend time with the body all night. They're not left in isolation. So you do encounter dead bodies. I've encountered my grandfather, my grandaunts, spending time with them the night that they're dead. So we had that relation. Obviously, this is the complete integral body. We're not doing any Bronze Age things to our relatives.
Yeah.
But it's that gap between death and life was narrower, that we'd experienced a dead body. So you've got that sense of the timing of letting the person go. It's not they're dead and they're put in a coffin and they're removed from you.
Yeah.
You've that transitional period. I think that's quite an important part of the mourning process.
Yes.
But I think with the way things have gone, you know, the family is often removed now from the burial process. If somebody dies, you're going to call. I know this seems, I'm speaking very much about Northwestern Europe when I talk about this, but I'm really speaking about my own experiences. So you're going to call an undertaker, and you've got somebody from outside the family is going to take the body, remove it, and deal with all of the burial practices, preparing the body for burial, actually physically closing the coffin, all these tangible, tactile things that a person might get to say goodbye to the person and experience them. We're cut off from that now. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also through the volume. That's a strange thing to say, but the volume of people, again, in larger cities and towns, the process has to be streamlined to actually manage to deal with this. It's when we look to our rural communities, we can still see the surviving ideas.
Yeah, I do wonder if they mourned better than in ancient times, if they did grieve better in a way.
I think that there's more space for that, yeah, but it's even that the secularization, like how many people are religious now? Do we believe in an afterlife, or do we believe when somebody's dead that, you know, that's them gone? So I suppose in some ways, in other societies, when that person's going on a journey, their soul goes on a journey, you're going to engage with the body differently. I think that makes an important contribution to how we deal with things differently now.
And have you got any other ongoing work or anything that you're planning that's really exciting at the moment, or even sort of not in the field of burial, anything that you'd love to share?
Well, I'm stuck with human remains for a period of time in the future because we're doing analyses of the genetics of these people. So over the last 20 years, especially over the last 10 years, we've been able to retrieve genetic data from ancient people. So because of that, we're able to look at things like how families are made up. We're able to look at things like migration, how people were moving, and broader stories about, you know, how societies were structured and how different groups of people experienced each other in the landscape. So that's what we're working on now. That's we've got preliminary findings. There's some quite exciting things coming out of that. In terms of, you know, sometimes people showing up where you weren't expecting people from a certain background to show up. Mm. You have other cases of, I'm speaking of my colleagues' work in Crete, where they've basically discovered that things like first cousin marriage was quite common. Things that we count as a social taboo. So genetics has a huge amount to tell us, and we're at the, well, midway through that journey. So that's, I think some of our future publications quite soon will be on the story that can tell us about these same societies.
Amazing. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Barry Malloy. Thank you for joining What We Did Before.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and it was great chatting with you.
A massive thank you to Barry Malloy. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. What we did before is independently made, so if you'd like to support us and help me make more episodes like this, there's a link in the description. Your support is greatly appreciated. I'm Ollie Gyu, and I will see you next time.